This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So why do you want to learn a new language?
I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
Coming up on StarTalk, Cosmic Queries. My friend and colleague Emily Rice is going to tell us all about the latest in brown dwarfs and exoplanets. Oh, yeah. That all comes to you from right here in my office at the Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum of Natural History.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now.
This is Star Talk, Cosmic Queries Edition. Got Chuck Nice with me. Chuck,
hey,
how you doing, man?
Hey, what's happening, Neil?
All right.
Yeah.
You know, there's a part of the universe that is a little foreign to me because most of my research back when I was, like, active with it was galaxies, large-scale structure, Big Bang.
All right.
And you come down, you get closer and closer and closer. There's a whole world there.
Right.
Literal and figurative world.
Okay.
People think about planets and stars being born around which you would find planets.
Right.
And we got one of the world's experts right here in the house.
Oh.
And here she goes.
Yes.
Emily Rice. Emily, friend and colleague. How you doing?
I'm very excited to be here again.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
To Star Talk. And just let the record show that whatever I'm wearing that's cosmic, and people say, oh, that's cool, that's cosmic.
Right.
I just want you to know that
Emily will come in with something cooler.
When I'm with my people, it's just camouflage,
right?
Because everybody else has got something.
Now it is,
And you are like leader of the pack there. Mm-hmm. Aren't you involved in some haberdashery or something?
Haberdashery.
What clothing?
A little bit of this, a little
don't
bit
you have
of that.
A jewelry line?
Yeah.
Or do you still have a jewelry line?
It's a super long story, but yeah, it started as a phenomenological, like we noticed people, you know, you were one of the originals, but other people were doing it too.
I mean, so, I'm an OG?
Look at that.
I think you might be one of the first. Yeah.
To be loud in my attire.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
But a bunch of people were doing it. And so we started a blog originally, Summer Ash and I. Summer was at Columbia at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were doing our outreach stuff and wearing our stuff, like our galaxy leggings and our NASA swag and stuff like that. We were like, this is so cool. Because some of the stuff we noticed was real, you know, real Hubble images and stuff like that. And so we started a blog we meant to like share it with the public. Like, oh, you bought this thing. What is it? Where did it come from? You know, astronomically, how was it obtained and
science,
stuff like that.
Add the science to it.
What I didn't expect is for the rest of the astronomers to be so into it that like we presented it at a research conference, but there's always room at the research conferences for outreach and education and things like that. And the number one question we got at our poster at the research conference was, where do I buy this stuff? The other astronomers.
The birth, right.
Yeah.
The genesis.
Can you make stuff with my science? And at the time, we were just finding things that were out there, you know, people's Etsy shops and small designers. Like, it was kind of everywhere.
You were an aggregator at the time.
Yeah. Curator, you know.
Cosmological Joan Rivers. Oh, who are you wearing? What galaxy is that? Oh.
Totally. And it's now become a shop. So long story short, like we became an online shop. So we create our own stuff as well. It's called Startorialist.
Startorialist. You see what she did there?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, cool. So it's online. We can find it online.
Yeah, Startorialist. I really thought it would be a fad that would just kind of happen and, you know, fade away, like not be popular anymore, which, you know, is kind of fine. But it hasn't. It's continued to grow. We've added our own stuff. So I say that we're the dark energy of the fashion universe.
Look at that.
For astronomy.
All right. Yeah.
Dark energy is a power of expansion.
Exactly.
It accelerates the expansion of the universe.
In other words, you're unaware of why you are successful.
Absolutely. Fully. It's not fully understood. It will be. We just need
maybe
a little more grant money.
Maybe. Right. We don't know. So your expertise is newborn stars, exoplanets, brown dwarfs.
Yeah.
And I have an issue, first of all.
Uh-oh.
So when I think of a star, it's self-luminous and it's burning bright, even though burning to us means something different
than to a chemist. Radiating.
Fusing bright.
Yeah, fusing bright, but that doesn't have the alliteration and it's not as cool.
Yeah. Right.
So stars will burn bright. Even if they're burning dimly, they still sort of are luminous in the infrared or somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. At no time am I thinking I'm looking at a brown object. So why did these objects, which are in the netherland between planets and stars,
yes.
Because I don't call planets brown, all right, because they're going to reflect light and they're going to have whatever colors they have. And I don't call stars brown. Where do you get the color brown from?
The color brown apparently came from Jill Tarter, who you've had on your show before.
Yes, so Jill's a friend of Star Talk.
Yeah.
Active with SETI, Jill Tarter.
Yeah. I watched her interview on Star Talk once and she told the story of her early career. It was actually in her PhD thesis where she did some research on these objects that were previously called black dwarfs. And so it started in the 60s.
Oh, so we had to take it away from the black. Well, that makes perfect sense.
Especially in the 60s.
Couldn't just let it be a black dwarf. Nope. No, we can't have that. Sure, a hole can be black. No problem. Yes, exactly. You know,
we have white holes too, apparently. That's
on paper, but not in a real thing. Okay,
but anyway, sorry.
So they were black dwarfs originally because the idea was that was purely theoretical. Was what happens when the stars don't have enough mass pushing down from the outside to get a high enough temperature at the inside to fuse hydrogen and helium as a steady source of power? And so
this is what the sun does every day of its life.
Yeah, so this is why the sun creates energy. It's a stable source of energy, of pressure pushing outwards against gravity. And the idea is that these things that started to form like stars but wouldn't have enough mass would kind of still continue to exist, but what would they look like? What would their structure be? How would they radiate? Things like that. That was first kind of described by a theoretical physicist in the 1960s. S.S. Kumar was his name. And then Jill Tarter, I think it was in 1975, in her thesis, kind of proposed the term brown dwarfs. And that kind of stuck. So she originally studied these objects. It's still at that point theoretical.
And of course, to Chuck's point, black holes were gaining very serious attention around that time.
Yeah. And so I think
early
that's
70s.
What's like the way that we call stuff dark now.
It was a cover story of the New York Times Magazine, black holes, what new research. So it took the word. I think you're right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then they realized, like, okay, they're not fully, you know, they're not fully unexplained. Like, they are reasonably well explained by, like, kind of normal physics. And so they moved away from black and just called them brown. Jill Tarter on your show said, oh, you know, so I started out doing this and then I wanted to do research that mattered.
Wow.
Talking about her shift into SETI, which I'm like, I can't argue with that too much, but it is a little bit of a diss. But it's an amazing, so she coined the phrase in 1975, And they still weren't known to exist. Like, they weren't actually discovered until the 1990s.
Even then,
it kind of took
a
while.
For context here.
Right.
And I hate thinking this way, but it just jumps into my head. You realize you just described something that happened 50 years ago.
Yeah, more than... We had a conference, actually, 50 years after to celebrate the original papers, 1963, 64. So that's already 10 years ago.
Had it been 1975 and we had this conversation, you'd be talking about 1925
right.
as 50 years
don't do
earlier.
That.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, God.
This, just to put that where...
Yes, in, put it in the proper context.
In the proper context.
You know, you guys old.
That was not what I was trying to look. Would you? Who asked you to comment?
It is amazing how far we've come and how quickly. Like, I do feel like the, you know, it's not typical. Like, this is the first time in our civilization, possibly, that these, like, cutting-edge research results are disseminated to the public so quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's actually something that I love doing at Startorialist. Like, there was the press release of the new polarized image of the black hole in the center of the Sagittarius star, the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Right.
And it came out, and I showed it to my students that day in class and described it to them.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I can put it on a T-shirt for you and sell it at Startorialist.
You know, the three of us sound a little bit like we're on the porch.
Right.
I remember when
and the youngins today.
I remember we had to teletype each other and let them know about the discoveries that we made.
Teletype. We had to send a telegram. Yes,
dots and dashes is how we had to tell people about our great significant discoveries.
Who started it?
Feels a little bit like that. So before we go on to our Q&A here, let me give your full dutiful introduction. You're a research associate here in our Department of Astrophysics of the American Museum of Natural History. Yep. And you even have a desk.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We get to count you as a resident research associate.
Nice.
So continued welcome.
Taking up space up here.
To those ranks. You're also associate professor of astrophysics at the Macaulay Honors College in CUNY, the City University of New York.
Yeah.
And you're in the faculty PhD program at the CUNY Grad Center. So yeah. you're all in there.
It's kind of all over the place, yeah.
And we see some students of yours that come through here.
Yep.
It's very communal. So
I bring my classes here as much as I can.
Yes! Yeah. Didn't I talk to your class one time? Yes.
Twice, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for bringing them by.
Here, yeah.
I'm delighted. Just call me. And you're a founding member of BDNYC.
Yeah.
Mm. And all those letters are like in subway symbols.
Right, I was going to say, yeah. And what line is that?
We are very proud. Oh, there's a whole story
behind
it.
There's no why.
There was no why. So we made up the why is kind of, we made it red and white in the center. There's no why train, but it's kind of the inverted inversion of the WNYC logo a little bit.
Gotcha.
But we had a joke going for a little while because these brown dwarfs, we have the stars that have the letters that go with them. And there's a whole story about that, right? OBAFGKM was, that was kind of set into order about 100 years ago mm-hmm. by the Harvard College computers or the Harvard Observatory women who were working as computers there. Annie Jump Cannon took that letters. And they were originally done by the strength of the hydrogen absorption line, but then they were realizing that actually it's a little bit different. It needs to be, if we order by temperature, we change up the letters. And so that's why it's not alphabetical anymore. But when we started to discover these
new... rather than re-letter them,
right.
They kept them.
And just rearranged
them. And confusing people
right.
for the century to follow.
You call it confusion, I call it job security. and there was apparently there was a bunch of different systems that they were devised, and a lot of controversy about it at the time. But since the brown dwarfs were discovered, so the M dwarfs are the coolest and the faintest stars. But for the brown dwarfs, we had to introduce new letters for the spectral type. And there are full papers going through the alphabet to say which letters should we use, basically. And so the next ones were L and T that were kind of proposed about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is like forever messed up my understanding of the alphabet because it goes M, L in stars. But then the next one, when we realized, okay, there might be things fainter than these T dwarfs, cooler than the T dwarfs, they're going to have different spectral characteristics and things like that. They proposed that there would be Y dwarfs. And so this was even in my like scientific career in the last 20 years or so. And so for a little while, we had a joke with the BDNYC logo where there was no Y dwarfs yet discovered, and there was also no Y train that we would have to explain to people from outside of New York City. Then the Y dwarfs were actually discovered with the Wide Field Survey Infrared Explorer, this NASA mission in the infrared. And so now the joke has been, become far too long to be actually interested anymore. But we're very proud of our BDNYC logo with the subway things on there. And I feel like
so,
we've kind
of upped
the game.
So it's a local community of people of like interest, professional interest.
Yeah, the three of us started at myself, Kelly Cruz, who's faculty at Hunter College in CUNY, and Jackie Faherty, who's senior scientist and educator here at AMNH. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, man, we over 10 years ago now, something like 14 years ago, we founded BDNYC. And it was one of the first groups that was like led by a bunch of women, you know, like it was still rare back then for kind of the three of us to be working together, leading papers together. We were counting how many papers could we find with only female authors, for example. We published one with just the three of us. We couldn't find another one that had any more.
There were no solo. There were not solo authors.
That were more than three authors, but only women.
It sounds like that Bechdel test on movies.
Yeah, right. It was kind of the BDNYC test or something like that.
Uh-huh. Sounds like black people in Utah.
If you see three in one street, there's something.
You're no longer in Utah.
That's the beer. It's getting better now, I feel like.
You were teleported
also,
in that instant. Exactly. As somebody.
Parallel dimension or something.
So, one last thing before we cross over. How does your interest in brown dwarfs take you to an interest in exoplanets?
Oh, they're very, very similar. So the interesting thing is that the difference in between brown dwarfs and stars is actually relatively straightforward, relatively. It's the nuclear physics on the inside. Mm-hmm. Like, it's whether they have enough mass to create the high enough temperature at the core to fuse hydrogen and the helium. Like, that's a big difference, kind of evolutionarily and
it's a clean
structurally.
Line, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, like, they either turn on,
so they
or they
ignited,
don't.
Or they didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
But for the lower mass things, it's not as clear. And originally, we wanted to have a similar definition, and so there was this lower mass demarcation that was 13 Jupiter masses instead of between the stars and the brown dwarfs. It's about 75 Jupiter masses, and that was again derived in like the 1960s. For the 13 Jupiter masses, we wanted to make this nice clean break between the brown dwarfs and the planets. And so 13 Jupiter masses is the mass.
Just to be clear what you're doing. You've turned Jupiter into its own measurement. Into its own measurement.
Oh, yeah. We always. Right. Oh, yeah. The masses.
I don't know how common an exercise that is in the rest of society. Okay? So, but yes.
In New York City, I don't know. Yeah, it's one block, but it's one avenue block versus one, you know, street block or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's whatever miles. But yeah, we do this in astronomy all the time. This is the great, like, astronomers, you know, we say astrophysicist if we want people to be impressed or something like that. We'll take anything and call it one or like set it relative to one another to make the math easier. Like we'll do anything to make the math easier.
Earth, sun, distance, goodness. Just one astronomical unit.
Well, this is there one. You go, one.
And how far away is it from the thing? It's 10 of us.
Right.
Or five of us. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So there's 13 Jupiter masses. Above that, there would be some nuclear fusion going on. So more massive than that, you might fuse a little bit of hydrogen, a little bit of lithium, because that's easier to fuse. Deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, is also easier to fuse. And so that easier means it will fuse at lower temperatures. And so above 13 Jupiter masses, there might be a little bit of fusion going on. And then below 13 Jupiter masses, they figured out there's no fusion going to happen ever. But the thing is that this like demarcation doesn't actually make a huge difference in the long term for these things. Like not in terms of the structure, not in terms of the evolution.
So how does it get you interested in an exoplanet?
Yeah. So the what ends up happening is that the brown dwarfs are actually really similar to the massive exoplanets. And some of these massive exoplanets are things that we found more easily than we found the Earth-like exoplanets.
So the size of your party grew.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 5-10 times the mass of Jupiter. We found those exoplanets around other stars even more easily.
So you find yourself at the same conferences as these other...
We used to have kind of, we called them cool stars conferences. And first the brown dwarf people went to the cool stars conferences. But then when the exoplanets got big enough, now there's a ton of different exoplanet conferences that the brown dwarf people go to. We kind of go to both too.
Yeah.
And we bring our karaoke along. But it's kind of like... Yeah.
And it's also where collaborations are born. I mean,
especially
you can't undervalue.
And then the planetary science people who have studied the planets in the solar system for so long are like, what are you guys doing? Because so much of it, you know, needs, like Jupiter, we know in a lot more detail, but there's still a lot of open questions. Saturn, we know in a lot more detail. Even Earth atmosphere stuff, brown dwarf people can learn in order to study these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true. Hey, remember when we did that show about the science of the golf swing? Well, let's take that to the next level. And that's because PXG has developed the Black Ops driver so golfers don't have to sacrifice distance for forgiveness. And the science proves it. PXG Black Ops driver is a breakthrough in driver technology. It's a complete and total victory in golf club engineering, unlike anything you've ever seen before. Black Ops drivers are adjustable to deliver a combined MOI of 10,000 plus for unreal forgiveness. Now that's ridiculously high. The higher the MOI, the more forgiving the club will play. So you don't have to square the ball perfectly for it to go straight and get distance. Add PXG's new advanced material face technology and you get incredible ball speed that pushes the distance to the absolute limit. More forgiveness, more distance, no sacrifices. PXG Black Ops driver. Hit your tee shot straighter and farther. The proof is in the science. Learn more and get free shipping on all equipment. Go to pxg.com/startalk and use code startalk at checkout. That's pxg.com/startalk. Use code startalk for free shipping on all equipment. pxg.com/startalk, code startalk.
Hi, I'm Ernie Carducci from Columbus, Ohio. I'm here with my son Ernie because we listen to Star Talk every night and support Star Talk on Patreon.
This is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Let's jump right in.
Okay, we got questions.
Let's do it.
And they are all from our Patreon people, and they are all for you specifically. All right, so this is from Laura Fortier. Says, greetings from Arizona. Hello, Drs. Rice and Tyson, Lord Nice. I have heard that brown dwarfs and hot Jupiters are similar. In what ways do they differ? And how are they made when they are clearly separated from a solar system? I heard somewhere that we don't really know how low-density stars are even created. Have we learned more?
Yeah.
People doing their homework before they come in on
you. Yeah, they really are.
So the hot Jupiters are one of these things that, like, we found around other stars that we haven't found in our solar system. And the hot Jupiter is a nice one because it is what it sounds like. It's a Jupiter-sized planet, Jupiter-mass planet.
That all the other planets think are super sexy.
Hot planets,
oh,
right?
Oh, hot Jupiter in the house. Okay, go ahead.
Close to its star so that it's irradiated by the star.
So it's not hot on its own.
That's the thing. It's not hot on its own. Yeah.
Oh, so that's a little
circumstantial. It gets hot from the star. Yeah. And so that's the interesting thing is that these hot Jupiters end up being similar to mass and maybe a similar temperature to a brown dwarf, but for a different reason.
For a different reason.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Like whether the radiation is coming from the outside or the inside. And so there's similarities, but there's also differences. Yeah. So those are one kind of overlap.
Thanks for clarifying that. Yeah. And what's the other part of that question?
She said, I heard somewhere we don't really know how low-density stars are created.
Ooh. Yeah.
So did they mean low-mass stars? What in low-density?
Yeah, they can be kind of the same. The interesting thing is that because of the physics going on at the very, very cores, these things kind of plateau in size, and so they do get lower and lower density.
Okay.
Because the mass decreases while the physical size stays the same. And so they do get lower and lower density, but we talk about them more in terms of their mass. Yeah, we don't fully know like how many of the low mass ones are out there. That's just like counting them. We don't fully know that. We don't really know how they formed or how low the mass can go when it forms a star does. Right.
Wait, why did we invite you to this?
Yeah.
Oh, so let's get to brass tacks. I have a gas cloud out there. There's so many beautiful images of gas clouds.
Yeah.
Hubble, from especially JWST.
Beautiful ones. Yeah.
So, and we see stars being born. Why weren't those stars born a billion years ago? Why are they being born now? What happened in that gas cloud ever at any time to make a star?
Oh, it depends on what
how does it know to make a high-mass star or a low-mass star?
Yeah. The universe just does that. Like, we don't necessarily,
Now, why'd she get away with that answer?
I was about to say, she actually gave you your answer, but much more succinctly, which is the universe is under no obligation to make sense to you.
That's true, yeah. That's kind of figuring it out and seeing if there's a law. So there does seem to be a law.
We should
allow that
in the PhD defense, the thesis defense.
Right.
So, excuse me, why do you get this? The universe just does that.
Right, exactly.
I feel like that is, as soon as you can say, confidently, I have no idea, or I don't know, or I don't think we can know, that's when you're an actual scientist.
Yeah, very
good. There's a lot of pressure to know the answer.
Very important philosophical point.
The confidence and the uncertainty, makes... That makes the scientist.
Because everybody else is trying to give an answer.
I was going
to
say, that is the difference between, I hate to bring it up, but science and religion. And you said somebody BSing you.
I said science
and religion. But
I didn't mean to conflate those two, but.
But no, it's the truth. Religion has an answer
for everything. Basically,
they have an answer.
Even when one answer contradicts the other answer.
It doesn't make a difference. I gave you an answer. That's very cool. Or I should say maybe it's my parents, which were, because I said so.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
That's the ultimate answer.
Because I said so. Mm-hmm. That's very cool. Yeah. All right, well, this is great. That was great. That was really informative. Thank you very much, Laura.
Her last name one more time.
Fortier.
Fortier.
Yes, very good. Which is not my forte to pronounce Fortier.
Nice.
Okay, this is Jason Dorickson. And Jason says, what is the largest dwarf star ever discovered? Oh, look at that. He's going for the jumbo shrimp angle. What is the largest dwarf star that we have actually seen?
That's a good question. I don't think I can answer that very concretely. And the reason why is because there's more weirdness here that I haven't even really touched upon, which is the fact that when the stars are formed, they kind of form and they start to fuse their hydrogen and helium, and they kind of, once they turn on, they stay that way for a while. They get stable.
Right.
Right? And so they have the same temperature, the same luminosity, the same mass for a long time. That's the other thing.
Same mass, except for the little bit they're losing when they convert it into energy.
Oh, yeah, but it's a tiny. Even for the small stars, it's a tiny bit of mass.
Tiny fraction
of mass. Even for the big stars, the mass doesn't change a huge amount with the nuclear fusion. But the big stars have shorter lifetimes, and the small stars have longer lifetimes.
Yeah.
So the low-mass ones?
The low-mass ones, we think they can last, and I can't believe we can throw around this number, but for a trillion years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not
you
can
throw it
anywhere.
Around because nobody understands what it is.
And probably nobody's going to be around to prove me wrong.
Way longer than the universe has been alive to this day.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Look at that.
But the tricky thing is, so that star becomes stable and kind of doesn't stay, but the brown dwarfs will kind of gradually cool and fade over time.
Okay.
They have this kind of residual heat left over from forming.
Right.
But then they just kind of cool and fade. And so as astronomers looking at them, we can't really tell whether we have a young, low-mass brown dwarf that's just formed or an old, high-mass brown dwarf that's been cooling off for a while.
Because they last for so long, you can't really tell. They look the same.
The stars last for a long, long time, but the brown dwarfs cool off.
Right.
Yeah, and so we have this, we call it the age-mass degeneracy. So we don't know if we have a young, low-mass thing that's just hot because it's still young, or an old, high-mass thing that's hot because it's a little bit higher mass, but it's been around for a long time. Because they're cooling off with time.
We have to get her explained degeneracy.
It's like where you can... Degeneracy is you can't tell the difference.
That's a lecherous brown dwarf.
I know, degenerate. Yes.
It has a gambling problem.
Oh, the brown dwarfs of today,
it's just not what they used to be.
Oh. I'm never going to be able to explain my research again. It's so fun. We get so used to using these terms.
Right.
And
so
don't think
so
about
degeneracy is a, it's a mathematical,
a physical term.
Physical
for us.
Mathematical. Yeah.
There's a couple different kinds even. So our degeneracy, the age mass degeneracy, is that you don't know one without constraining the other. So it's ambiguity is the colloquial, like that's the...
Two things look alike, but they can be very different from each other and are just happen to look alike in that moment. And you can't distinguish one from the other without another dimension
way
of
to
data.
Measure. Yeah, we have to be able to measure the mass somehow, or we have to be able to measure
You need another data point
somehow.
to break the degeneracy.
Gotcha.
And there's another degeneracy.
Yeah, and then the other degeneracy is like the cores of the objects are partially degenerate, we say. And that's like a quantum mechanical thing where the actual electrons in the atoms get so close together that they fill up the quantum states, and that provides pressure against the mass pushing
down.
Can't
keep squeezing down.
Wow.
So that's called degeneracy pressure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've forgotten we have degeneracy used in two completely different ways.
Yeah, they are two different.
Right.
I never thought about that before either.
It's
such a weird... We speak our own language sometimes.
Yeah.
And so this high mass, so it's really hard to tell actually exactly how high mass something is. Like nominally we have the 75 Jupiter mass cutoff, but we also don't know, is it younger, is it old or something like that?
Which will factor into whether or not it is or it isn't, which factors into whether it's the largest brown dwarf we've ever seen.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow. You put all the, that's rough.
It's weird.
Science is hard.
That's rough, man.
Science is hard.
Yeah.
You don't just look through a telescope. Here's the answer to that question.
Find new problems as soon as you dig a little bit deeper.
So, Jason, the answer to your question is we don't know. We don't know, man. I'm sorry.
How many is that? I think that's, I don't know for the
you're
first
up to like five
so
here,
far.
You know,
All
right.
That's pretty cool, though. I love it.
But who is it that says the only thing I know is that I know nothing? What's that quote?
All I know is that I don't know nothing. That's Operation Ivy, but.
No, I think before that. I'm thinking ancient Greece, Socrates.
Socrates and Operation Ivy.
So it'd be Socrates, actually.
Socrates Johnson.
Socrates, it was, if I know anything at all, it's that I know nothing.
Right.
So I'm paraphrasing.
So.
All right, this is Noble Gobble. And Noble Gobble says, salutations, doctors and Lord. My name is Caleb Noah Getten. Mm-hmm. Okay. Noetkin. There you go. My name is Caleb Noetkin. Oh, thanks, Caleb. He says, good luck with that one.
He even knows.
Son of a gun.
He knows.
I can't believe you, man. Then he says, this is Caleb from Wichita, Kansas.
People are getting no respect.
Cold-blooded. He's letting the cat mash on the keyboard. Chuck is going to have fun with this one.
Yeah, tell me about it. He says, since brown dwarfs are sort of an intermediate object between a planet and a star, I was wondering if there was a common trend between mass composition and magnetic field strength.
Oh, gosh. Magnetic field.
Look at that.
This is one of those things where if you want to trip up an astronomer, you ask them about dust or you ask them about magnetic fields.
Right.
And it's nice because it applies really across any kind of research. We try to ignore it because those things complicate things hugely. These things do have magnetic fields, but we actually don't know how the magnetic fields are generated on these stars. We think we know how magnetic fields are generated on the sun because there's this cool thing called the tachocline. Mm-hmm. And it's like these moving charges are going to generate the magnetic field. And we think that's where it comes from on the sun. And that tachocline is a border between radiative zone and a convective zone.
Okay.
So there's energy transport is happening in different ways. But for brown dwarfs, what we think we understand of the structure, and this is all from modeling things and understanding how energy transport is supposed to happen, we think at some point they become fully convective.
Okay.
So this is kind of cool. It's like the convection is this big bulk motion of meat, of material that happens when you like boil water and stuff like that. So it's relatively familiar.
It's like an internal churning?
Yeah, it's this internal churning. But instead of the churning only going down part of the way inside the stars, which it does for the higher mass stars, it goes all the way down.
So the two of those together, you have a radiative effect, which is the outward pushing of the star, and then you have the internal churning, and the two of them together, like the Earth's core rolling around inside of us, makes a magnetic field? Is that?
Well, we don't know for the brown dwarf. That's the thing, is that because—
I'm trying to figure it out.
We don't know.
I went to seven I don't knows.
Yeah. So we also think the magnetic fields are going to be different across the different types of
dwarfs. So why did you call it a something Klein and not
a tachocline?
Not just a dynamo? Or is a dynamo the broader term?
Dynamo is the broader term that generates the magnetic fields. Yeah. Am I messing up my solar physics? Hopefully not. I could be. Somebody can get their 5 cents back.
Right.
Their $5 back.
So what is the difference between that and a star? Because we know that's what it happened, like in our own sun.
Yeah, in our own sun, we've kind of got these bigger motions. In the brown dwarfs, we don't know fully where. There isn't this separation between the inner layers. And so we don't know where the brown dwarf, where the magnetic field comes from.
Gotcha.
But there is a magnetic field. We see spots on the low mass stars and on the brown dwarfs. We see aurora.
Spots is good evidence of
on the brown dwarfs.
Field.
Yeah, both
on the,
of those
on the
things.
Sun, spots always come in pairs.
Right.
And one is plus and one is minus.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, it's a cool fact.
There's a bright spot that goes along with the dark spot. Yeah, I think the bright spot is harder to see usually.
Look at that.
Yeah.
That is the first I've ever heard of that.
Yeah. And the solar wind that we're going to
Here's something
see.
Else I heard, which is consistent with what you just said. Back in my day, you would accuse someone of, if they're presenting their research, and they say, the bigger is the effect of a magnetic field in what they describe, the less they know about the subject. The less they can explain, they put in more magnetic field, which is what accounts for everything that they don't otherwise know.
Yeah. Magnetic fields are challenging. They're very hard to understand.
Astrophysically,
in a lab, we got it.
Right.
But yeah. Yeah,
if we're talking magnets, it's no big deal. But Wow. Well, Caleb, that was a great question, man.
Three, I don't know. We're up to
it doesn't make a difference. Here's
I was counting seven, but if it's only three, good. All right.
But this is what I'm loving about the I don't knows. Every time we don't know something, I learn something. Like something else comes out of it that I've never heard before.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the third time that we've didn't had an I don't know. But every single time, there's something really cool that we find out. In place of I don't know.
And by the way, it's also a measure that the field is very much embedded in its own frontier.
Right.
When you're on a frontier, every step you take is into the unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are over 75 million monthly Tubi viewers. That's more people than there are in France. Which means Tubi is more popular than cigarettes for breakfast. It's more popular than considering iced coffee a total abomination. More popular than loving political revolutions. More popular than mère and mère somehow being different words. Tubi, it's more popular than being French. See you in there.
Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
Do you want to set up your child for success? Of course you do. Maybe you want to save money on private tutoring, or maybe it's just out of your budget altogether. Is this a big school year for your child? Like maybe they're starting kindergarten, middle school, or high school, or some other milestone. Maybe your family moved and they're starting at a new school. Is your child ahead? Not getting challenged enough in class? Well, we love that little smarty, but we want him to be engaged. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or the personality. There's one site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids can use it at home on the computer or on the go through the app on your phone or your tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything itself. And no more trying to figure out how to explain math equations or grammar rules yourself. IXL has built-in explanation videos. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And StarTalk Radio listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/StarTalk. Visit IXL.com/StarTalk to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Okay, this is Atticus Thompson. Atticus says, hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr.
Is this,
Rice.
Is this a letter from the Civil War? We need that voice.
My dearest Dr. Tyson and Dr. Rice, today was an especially difficult day.
Son, Atticus. Is anybody named Atticus today?
No. They're all in Brooklyn.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
yeah, it's a 100%. Thing. They're all at the playgrounds in Brooklyn right now,
and
I guarantee you.
Are so you. Right.
Wow.
But that's Atticus from Atticus Finch.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, okay. I would think. But anyway, he says, my name is Atticus.
Stop.
And I'm 9 years old.
Oh, he's 9?
Okay. He says, I live in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee.
All right.
Wow. I want to know if two brown dwarfs collided. Do they become a larger brown dwarf, or would they just become a low-mass star?
Ooh,
that is a very good question.
Okay, so Atticus, first of all, you ain't fooling nobody. I don't care if you're 9 or not. I know your father helped you with this question.
What are you talking about?
You're not fooling anybody, Atticus.
I'm Atticus, and I'm 9 years old. I would like to know.
Wait, dude, when I was 9, I could ask that.
You could ask that question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
See, yeah. That's when I was going to say, you're going to work for Atticus someday.
My interest in the universe was birthed when I turned 9 years old.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, Atticus, I take it back. No, I don't.
No. You want to get at him? Ask him if he paid the $5.
Yeah, but if he's asking questions like that, he might have a job. I'm just saying.
Okay, so what happens when stars collide?
Yeah, it's going to depend on their mass.
Really?
Yeah, it's not outside the realm of possibility if you have, like, that's just a multiplication or an addition problem, really. If the two brown dwarfs come together and have more than that 75 masses,
Jupiter mass.
In
Jupiter?
Theory, yeah, it could ignite hydrogen fusion.
Right.
Wait, so the whole star will reorganize.
Right.
Quite possible. It's something that we don't like expect it to happen a lot, I don't think.
It wouldn't
think,
be an object with two separate cores, we don't think, because gravity and
they would
friction
kind of
would
like,
bring it
as
together.
As they get closer together, they would get like torn apart a little bit. And so it
and
would probably,
kind of,
like if they did coalesce.
And then coalesce again.
Yeah. We know this happens for... like the higher mass stars, because we see that, you know, black hole mergers are what trigger the gravitational waves. We have, you know, stellar mergers, like it creates more energy. And so we have more evidence of it for the high mass stars. So we don't really think about it too much for the low mass stars, because I think we don't have a lot of super close binaries. Like there's not going to be a huge amount of energy loss, like you're going to need some kind of energy loss to get them to get closer and closer together. To one
Somebody
another.
Has to eat the energy of their orbit.
Right. Yeah,
their orbital energy.
If they're going
to
come
Otherwise,
together.
That's why we don't just collide into the sun right now.
It's a very slow process for any kind of orbital change like that.
So and
but if it did happen...
And blue stragglers are similar
Yeah,
objects.
That's how these weird stars yeah.
Wait,
kind
what's
of...
what's a blue straggler?
You know about the blue straggler?
No. Yeah. Tell me. Because...
Yeah, yeah. So you look at a cluster of stars all born together. So they all should be evolving... together as we understand stellar evolution. And there's some stars that are like hotter and bluer than anybody else is. And it was a big, in my day, it was a big mystery until someone said, maybe these are two stars that have merged.
Merged.
And when you merge,
so they've become hot again.
You get to re-energize your core with fresh material.
Right.
So that you will have a prolonged life expectancy and you'll come out a little hotter than you're otherwise supposed to
be. They're the late bloomers of the summer nursery.
Well, they got an injection of new
had a growth spurt over the summer. Look at me.
Yeah, so they stand out from all the rest of the stars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, blue stragglers because everyone else has evolved together.
Yeah, because they all were born together.
They were born together, and this one got an extra infusion.
And the high mass ones, especially, are bluer to begin with and shouldn't live as long.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so these are standouts. So I never thought about the brown dwarf. You can ignite a brown dwarf that otherwise would have had to live its life.
Yeah. In theory, I think. In practice, I don't think we see it a lot. We do see, you know, it's hard to tell whether or not things are binaries. Yeah, maybe they just turned into these stars.
Could be.
Maybe they're just a star you're ignoring over on the side and it used to be two brown dwarfs.
Would we see evidence of it? It's
hard
to...
very well be.
Hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
Look at that. Mm. Like a YouTuber that actually crossed over to regular entertainment.
What?
Okay, anyway, sorry.
That's how though.
So this is Atticus?
That was Atticus.
Atticus, thank you, Atticus.
That's a very
Thompson,
good question.
That was a great question.
And you know
Atticus.
He's building something in his basement. You know,
something I don't want anything to know about, but I'm sure the U.S. government does.
The power grid dims once a week as he turns on his experiment. All right.
Okay, here we go. This is Jimmy Go Lightly. This is Holly's brother. Says, hi, this is James in Charlotte. How does the life...
Wait, for those who were not alive in 1964...
Oh, it's still on the, it's still on the movie channel.
Is it? Okay.
The Turner Movie Classics. It's a great movie.
Yeah, so that was...
What's her face?
Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Audrey Hepburn.
Audrey Hepburn.
She was Holly Golightly.
Holly Golightly.
Based on the novel by... Truman Capote.
Truman Capote, yeah.
Okay,
you didn't know that?
I did not know.
You're learning something every day here.
Let me tell you, that's why I come here.
Okay.
Because I'm stupid. All right, this is, he says, hey, James and Charlotte here. How does the lifespan of a low-mass star compare to the lifespan of other stars such as our sun?
Yeah.
So.
The brown dwarfs are going to be around forever. That's what makes them super useful. Yeah, the sun is going to stably fuse hydrogen for about 10 billion years, and we're about halfway through that. So if you want something to worry about, like the sun is about halfway through its lifetime. But the brown dwarfs, like we said, are going to last basically forever, for like our practical definition of forever, which we use it in kind of a neat way, which is we call it galactic archaeology. Because some of the low mass stars that we can see now might have been around already since very early on. The high mass stars are going to have come and gone, but the low mass stars are going to be around. And one of the interesting things is that...
Well, but you can make a low-mass star today.
Yes.
And it'd be a low-mass star. But some of the pool of low-mass stars could have been born first.
Yeah. Right at the very beginning.
And it's still alive.
Might ask, how can we tell the difference?
How are you going to know the difference?
And we
or
can
is
tell
it degenerate?
That, yeah. We can. This way we can tell the difference. And the answer lies in those high-mass stars. Because the high-mass stars that have been fusing and then exploding have been creating heavier elements. And so the older a low-mass star is, the longer ago it was formed, the fewer heavy elements it's going to have.
Okay.
And so the more recently formed low-mass stars are going to have more of the heavy elements that were created in the subsequent generations of high-mass stars, which is kind of cool if you think about it.
You get spectra and look at those elements.
Yeah, so you get the spectra, you look at the elements, and we have a special name for the low, we call it low metallicity because we call this composition, how many heavy elements are in it, we call that metallicity. The low metallicity stars are called subdwarfs.
Oh.
Because they're under the main sequence of stars on this HR diagram.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little bit weird, but... And they also tend to be blue in color.
Subdwarfs.
Yeah. That's super cool, man.
They are fun to study.
Because they reveal themselves as their own population.
Yeah, subsolar metallicity.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. This is Matt Curtis. Matt says, hello, Doc Lord. Matt here, and Chuck is pronounced Matt.
Stop. Jeez.
Well, these people
just in case.
These people are brutal today, man. They are brutal.
Chuck is pronounced Matt.
coming from South Carolina here. Given that our space telescope technology is improving and we keep discovering more and more exoplanets, what will it take to directly capture an image of one of them? Deducing their existence through transit or gravity wobble is great, but what improvements would be required to show an image to the public directly?
Oh.
You so want to see like oceans and continents.
He wants to see. You want, so it depends.
He wants a travel brochure.
Yeah. If you want to, so I like to call, because we do have images of exoplanets.
Right.
This is an amazing direct thing. Imaging. Direct images of exoplanets. Nice. It's hard. Well,
how many pixels?
Yeah, a handful. And how many planets? It's like also 10 planets maybe or something like that. But one of them has stood the test of time. So this is also kind of back in my day of exoplanets. Back in 2008, two directly imaged exoplanets were announced. One was in around the star Fomalhaut, which famously had a disk. And it was a little like bright thing in the disk. And then there's another.
And that star is a southern hemisphere.
That's a pretty bright star, though. It's got a name. Like a star with a relatively normal name is a star that you can see in the night sky. And then the other one was HR8799, which with a number like that, you can't see it in the night sky. But it had three planets detected around it. And both of these, one was done with the Hubble Space Telescope, one was done with a ground-based telescope. But they're amazing discoveries. It's a handful of pixels and it's really fuzzy images. It's like, meh. But the Fomalhaut one actually seems to have been a spurious discovery. Like, it's just a clump in the disk that kind of didn't move the way it was expected to move and has since gone away. The HR8799 system, they found another planet even closer in. So there's four planets in the system. And you can, over the time, put the images together and watch the planets orbit.
Oh, wow.
It's beautiful. And that's so somebody, Jason Wang, I believe his name is, has made GIFs that every once in a while go around social media of a little animation of the images where we can watch planets orbit around a star other than the sun, which I think is just amazingly...
It's crazy. I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it.
We haven't found that many
takes
more.
But years to go around its host star.
Right.
You need data over that entire
decades,
time.
Right? Yeah, basically.
To really get the
good. Yeah, right. And the HR8799 system is like a souped up solar system. Mm-hmm. It's a bigger star than the sun. The planets are bigger. They're like 5 to 10 times the mass of Jupiter. And they're all further out than our gas
giant
planets.
So it's bigger and brighter.
Planets,
so
but similar.
That's cool, man.
Time for one more question.
All right. Okay, so since we're on exoplanets, let's do Paula Patsova, who says, hello, Dr. Rice, Dr. Tyson, Lord Nice. Paula here from Slovakia. What is the potential of habitability of orbiting planets around a brown dwarf or low mass stars?
Good one.
Especially the low mass star. Like the brown dwarfs, maybe, but they're kind of the extension of the low mass stars. But the low mass stars, like they might actually be better targets for finding Earth. I don't want to say Earth-like, but I'll say Earth-size planets at the very least. Because for these indirect methods that were mentioned earlier, the indirect methods, it's easier to see small planets relative to small stars. Mm-hmm. It's easier to see planets close into the stars.
Right.
And so both of those mean that if you look around a small star, it's easier to find Earth-size planets and kind of Earth-temperature planets.
Okay.
So they're, because those are going to be closer into the star because it's a cooler star. So it's like a smaller fire.
I mean, if you're going to have an Earth-temperature,
right?
Yeah.
And it's way dimmer or way less luminous than our sun, you got to be way closer.
You can be closer
to get that same temperature.
Yeah, to get that same equilibrium temperature. But then it's easier to find that planet with these indirect methods that we use most of the time. And so now these small stars have been like really intriguing targets for searching for exoplanets.
Right.
And so the TRAPPIST-1 system is a very famous system that was discovered a handful of years ago with 7 Earth-sized planets in orbit around that star. And like something like 3 or 4 of them
TRAPPIST is the name of the star.
Well, weirdly enough, the star was known before. TRAPPIST is actually the acronym for the survey.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The catalog.
Transiting, blah, blah, blah. But it's a Belgium, the group includes Belgium Observatory.
Okay.
And so we call it a backronym sometimes where they think of the clever term that they want and then they make up the acronym to go with it.
A backronym.
Backronym. Yeah, that's a fun portmanteau. So this TRAPPIST-1 system is super great because a solid 3 or 4 of those planets could be in the habitable zone.
Right.
Around. So the habitable zone is where it's the right temperature for liquid water.
Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, Goldilocks zone. But it doesn't tell you anything about the atmosphere, which you would also need to have liquid water on the surface. And so there's still a lot of unknowns, a lot of what ifs for those. But the low mass stars are really exciting targets for Earth size exoplanets, at least.
Wow. Cool. Exciting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, Emily, thank you. You don't
Thanks
come on here
me.
Often enough. We got to bring...
I'm around.
We'll just reach
She's
out.
Like, I'm right upstairs.
No, just upstairs.
Yeah.
Walking by.
Call me. Well, thank you for bringing back your expertise on this zone of ignorance that existed for so long that finally people are jumping in.
Yeah.
Getting their hands dirty.
Yeah. We've always kind of wondered, right? Yeah. But now we know for sure, which is amazing.
Very
a
cool.
A lot of the things.
All right. All right.
Good stuff.
All right. Well, let me take us out with some reflections.
Okay.
On this moment.
Mm.
In my field, astrophysics, many of us confront people who ask the very sensible question, why are we spending money on anything you're doing when we have all these problems here on Earth? And, okay, before we did all of this, did you not have those problems on Earth? I think you had them long before any of us spent a dime of tax money or any other money trying to understand the universe. What we do know is what we discover expands our view, not only of the world, but of our place within it. And when I was growing up, there were planets and there were stars. And no one really thought much about, well, how do you get between one and the other in the universe? What does the universe say about that? And then we learned there's an entire field that we didn't even know would exist or could exist, and now does exist, that specializes in the transition between what you are as a planet and what you would become as a star. This is more about our world, our universe, our home. And it could be that this will help us discover life on a planet around a star sometime in our future. And so whether or not that specifically puts food on your table, I'll ask you a little differently. I'll say, how much is the universe worth to you? And that's Cosmic Perspective. Neil deGrasse Tyson here for Star Talk. Cosmic Queries. As always, keep looking up.
Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.